Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Monday, so this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column sometime in the last 10 years. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on September 18th of 2016 under the headline, Former Albany Newsman Saved Crater Lake for a National Park. Here we go. In Oregon, there's one place where you're allowed to fish for free, and you've got a former Albany newspaper owner to thank for that. It's in Oregon's famous Crater Lake where you can wet a line without paying the man, yet very few people ever do because the lake is one of the largest bodies of water in the state, not in terms of surface area, of course, but it's so deep it holds an enormous amount of water, and the fish colony isn't big. It's free because the fish aren't supposed to be there. Crater Lake never had fish in it before, and that's part of why its water is so clear and brilliantly blue. So, how did the fish get there? Well, that gets back to the newspaper man. His friends called him Will Steele, but when he founded the Albany Herald in 1880, his name was listed as William Gladstone Steele. Steele was originally from Ohio, where his family participated in the Underground Railroad before the Civil War. His family later moved to Portland, and he graduated from high school there in 1873. 7 years later, Steele went into the newspaper business, founding the Albany Herald as a Republican challenger to the town's dominant newspaper, the State's Rights Democrat. The Herald would soldier on for half a century before being absorbed into its rival to form today's Albany Democrat Herald, but its founder didn't stick with it nearly that long. By 1885, he was back up in Portland working as superintendent of mail carriers, a job secured for him by his brother who had the plum political patronage job of postmaster there. In that summer, Steele took a vacation from his job to make his first journey to Crater Lake. He took a friend with him and by chance met up with two other pilgrims, including Captain Clarence Dutton of the U.S. Geological Survey, who would in later years be probably his most valuable ally in the fight to preserve the lake. Upon his return, Steele soon found that he no longer had a job with the post office. After 25 years of Republican dominance, the White House had been won by Democrat Grover Cleveland, and political plums like the postmastership of Portland were not to be left in the hands of Republicans. The Steele brothers were out. But for Will, the timing couldn't have been better. Suddenly, at loose ends, he was free to act on the powerful feelings his visit to the lake had inspired. Back east, he raced to Washington, D.C., where, with Dutton's support, he convinced the president, who'd fired him shortly before, to block settlement in the area till it could be surveyed. Then Steele returned to Portland, hired a survey crew, and had three boats built and hauled to the lake, where they floated out on the water to take soundings. Steele found that he hadn't brought enough line. He suggested that the lake might actually be bottomless. Finally, with more line, the crew found the deepest part, just shy of 2,000 feet. After getting Steele's report, Congress introduced a bill to preserve the lake and 36 square miles of the surrounding terrain as a national park, and the fight was on. There were a lot of trees on those 36 square miles, and several companies wanted to turn those trees into money. There were also plenty of opportunities to run sheep on the land, particularly in the eastern part, and the grazing interests were, if anything, more intransigent than the timber seekers. Steele fought tirelessly for his park. Realizing that outdoorsmen, yes, men, remember this was the late 1880s, could help his cause, Steele decided to stock the lake with trout. So he offered some kids in Rogue River a dime for every minnow they caught. They brought him 600. A very worried and out-of-pocket Steele asked what they wanted for the lot, and they requested 4 bits. Relieved, Steele gave them each a buck and took the minnows 45 miles to the lake. At each stream, he stopped to freshen the water, but most of them were dead by the time he got to the lake. Still, 37 of the original 600 survived to initiate the present-day problem there, although most of the fish in the lake today are descendants of the tens of thousands of hatchery fingerlings with which the lake was stocked in the early 1900s. Steele also, during that time, founded the Oregon Alpine Club, a diverse outfit composed of campers and outdoors people of all sorts, possibly with the same idea in mind. More appreciators of nature meant more support for his lake. A few years later, he organized the state's famous Mazama Club, open only to people who had climbed Mount Hood. Finally, after a 17-year fight with the timber and grazing interests in Congress, Steele saw his dream realized. In 1902, Congress officially made Crater Lake the nation's fifth national park. By that time, Steele's was the name most associated with the park. Without his efforts, it almost certainly would not have happened. And when he started styling himself the father of Crater Lake, no one objected. But it wasn't all roses and laurels and victory laps. When the park was created, the government passed over Steele for park superintendent and named William Arendt, a rancher from Klamath Falls, to the job. This was almost certainly because the park's administration didn't want someone as effective, independent, and well-connected as Steele in the job. Still, Steele took it very hard. After that rebuff, nothing would ever be enough for him. For the rest of his life, no matter how many accolades were showered upon him, he constantly complained of being underappreciated. Steele did get the job of superintendent at Crater Lake some years later, after more or less forcing Arendt out of the job, but was only able to hang on to it for a few years. After that, he was made commissioner of the park. Essentially, he was kicked upstairs, promoted to a prestigious but powerless position to get him out of the way. As commissioner, he was essentially the park's presiding magistrate for when a judge was needed, but the job was almost entirely superfluous, and he held that position until his death in 1934. Key sources in this story have included works by Rick Harmon, Stephen R. Mark, and Bill Gulick. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 500 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a Twitter feed, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources. All accessible via our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com or find them on their MySpace page. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode, email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday morning, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.